For our opening words this morning, I'd like to share an earth prayer that was written by Joanna Macy and John Seed, who are ecological activists and are very much aligned with the Unitarian Universalist movement. And it goes like this. What are you? Who am I? Intersecting cycles of water, earth, air, and fire. That's what I am. That's what you are. Water, blood, lymph, mucus, sweat, tears, inner oceans tugged by the moon, tides within, out, and tides within and out, streaming fluids floating our cells, washing and nourishing through endless riverways of gut and vein and capillary. Moisture pouring in and out of you in the vast poem of the hydrological cycle. You are that. I am that. Earth. Matter made from rock and soil. It too is pulled by the moon as the magma circulates through the planet's heart. And roots suck molecules into biology. Earth pours through us, replacing each cell in the body every 7 years. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. We ingest, incorporate, and excrete the earth, are made from earth. I am that. You are that. Air, the gaseous realm, the atmosphere, the planet's membrane, the inhale and the exhale. Breathing out carbon dioxide to the trees and breathing in the fresh exudations. Oxygen kissing each cell awake. Each cell awake. Atoms dancing through space and time. And the same fire as the lightning that flashed into the primordial soup, catalyzing the birth of organic life. You were there. I was there. For each cell of our bodies is descended in an unbroken chain from that event, through the desire of atom for molecule, of molecule for cell, of cell for organism, and our sexuality, we can feel ancient stirrings that connect us with plant as well as animal life. We come from them. An unbroken chain through fish, learning to walk the land, feeling scales, turning to wings through the migrations and the ages of ice. We have been but recently born in human form. It's Earth's whole history. We're compressed into 24 hours, beginning at midnight. Organic life would begin only at 3 p.m. Mammals, we, as a part of that chain, emerged at 11:30. And from amongst them, at only seconds to midnight, our species. Amazing. Welcome. Welcome to the marvel of what it means to be living and breathing on this beautiful November morning. Take a moment to greet your neighbors and say hello. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, good morning. Good morning. This morning we light our chalice, our flaming chalice, to remind ourselves that we gather to inspire one another to live with greater understanding and compassion for all that lives, to care for this precious gift of life with all our intelligence and the creative spirit, which encourages us to be playful as we work to correct the harm done to the ecosystems that we rely on for life. In that spirit and that energy, I light our chalice. Now let us sing our opening hymn, All Creatures of Earth and Sky, 203. Stand and sing as you were able. I draw your attention to our announcements in our order of service, and I have a couple in addition to those that structure our community life. This was found in the back of our sanctuary, so if this belongs to one of your electronic devices, you can claim it after the service. I think so. I don't know. It's one of those things that go in one place and go in another place. So the Manhattan Alliance for Peace and Justice will sponsor a discussion of the Keystone Pipeline on Tuesday, November 5th at the Congregational Church, Points in Juliet. Potluck meal at 6:30, program at 7:15, questions, talk to Ann Cowan. And please, if you haven't already joined us, and if you have, join us for the Action Wednesday potluck, which is coming up this Wednesday. Everyone is welcome, but you should especially consider coming if you are looking for more or different ways to be involved. The theme is communications, so if you have any ideas about getting our message to the public, come. It starts at 6, and the meeting times begin at 7, and there is childcare. Ours is a welcoming community where we find connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our joys are amplified, a community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our joys and sorrows and acknowledge the mutual support of our community. If you have a personal joy or sorrow, please share it now.
Good morning, I'm Sue Prey, and our fellowship, all of us, would like to congratulate you, Michael and Chuck, in having nuptials this Thursday.
No, it'll be November 17th.
17th, which falls on a...
Sunday.
Sunday. Well, should we all as a congregation say congratulations on the count of three? One, two, three. Congratulations!
Thank you.
My mom is not feeling well yet.
Yes.
I have a joy that I'm going to be learning calligraphy.
Great.
Yes, my name is Ron Parks, and it's my pleasure to introduce my wife, Judy, who's joining us this morning. And we've had our children and their families come in and spend an abbreviated weekend with us, son Casey from Phoenix and daughter Tony from Oklahoma City. So it's been a real nice weekend, and we're pleased to be here.
I want to share a joy today. My family, we have a neighbor across the street who's a wonderful young woman in her 20s. She has two little children. She's a single mom, and she works full-time. She's been suffering from a hereditary blood clotting disorder, which led to pulmonary embolism and a whole lot of other really complicated things over the past couple years. She's had 13 surgeries over the past 2 years, and apparently it was lucky 13, the last surgery that she had last week, and it has relieved the problem. She's got sensation in her feet again for the first time in 2 years. And we just feel so happy about that. So I want to share that joy. Mm.
I was able to get together with all my family in Kansas City last weekend, all my 5 kids and my 5 grandchildren and all their partners. And so it was a big group of us. We went out for a walk, and I thought, what have I done? We're strung out all along the trail. And then another joy, my son came to visit this weekend and helped me with, I'm looking for a new word for computer or technology-induced anxiety. So he came out to help me cope with that. If anyone knows a good word, I want to know it. I have it often.
I'm an L. Forrester, and my son's father-in-law, Arlie Regeer, who's a sculptor, metal sculptor, is in hospice. So please send warming thoughts to the whole family. This is a rough week.
This morning it was our joy to welcome new members and potential new members or people who are just interested for a breakfast and conversation. And in the midst of that, I got a phone call from a woman who said that she's estranged from her daughter and her grandchildren because they are on a very difficult path. And she asked us to keep her in her heart, our hearts. So even people we don't know were invited to have compassion for. So I said I would extend that wish for compassion out to all of you. So extend it out to whomever may need it. So, if you may we remember those who have spoken, those we have named, and those we hold in our hearts with silence. All right. Sarah Lott's going to take over for Jennifer, who is sick this morning, and the children, she'll need your help.
Unfortunately. All right, so today we're going to be talking about spiritual ecology and about our experiences reading this book here. So I'm going to read you a short passage, and then we'll read this other book here. So, from Thomas Berry, what do you see when you look up at the sky at night, at the blazing stars against the midnight heavens? What do you see when the dawn breaks over the eastern horizon? What are your thoughts in the fading days of summer as the birds depart on their southward journey, or in the autumn when the leaves turn brown and are blown away? What are your thoughts when you look out over the ocean in the evening? What do you see? Yes.
I see the moon.
Very good. Does anybody else want to share what they see, possibly what's right outside these windows here? Yes. Very good. The falling of the leaves. Yes.
I see the tree.
The trees. Yes, there's a very...
So we get the kids.
Oh. Can you say it again?
I see the trees. The trees are turning yellow.
I see the constellations and stars.
I see winter.
Clouds.
I see birds, flocks of birds flying away.
So many of you noticed the trees outside, because that is the book that Jennifer picked out for us today. It's called If I Were a Tree, illustrated by Dar Hosta. All right. Oh, how would it be if I were a tree? If I were a tree, my favorite colors would be green and yellow and orange, and red. If I were a tree, I would have conversations with the sky and the sun and the stars and the moon. If I were a tree, I would wave to you whenever the wind blows. How would it be if you were a tree? If I were a tree, I would bring you a burst of blossoms in the springtime. If I were a tree, I would give you cool shade in the summer. If I were a tree, I would show you colorful leaves in the fall. If I were a tree, I would be quiet and still and patient through winter's chill. And I would let the snowflakes rest on my branches. So how would it be if you were a tree? If I were a tree, I would be a pear tree and bear a season's golden treasure. I would be a lemon tree and life would be forever sweet. I would be an apple tree so that you could make a pie. If you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be? I would be a cherry tree just to make you cheery. I would be a city tree and remind you of the whispers of the leaves. I I would be a happy tree and a friend to all the creatures of the earth. If I were a tree, my branches would always be full of song and would cradle or nest for you to come home to. Oh, yes, if I could not be me, it would be nice to be a tree. So, what kind of trees would you guys like to be?
If I were a tree, I would like to be an apple tree to make everybody feel happy because my family likes apples.
Nice.
I would like to be a dogwood tree. I would like to be an orange tree.
I would like to be a redwood tree.
I would like to be a cherry tree.
I would like to be a cherry tree.
I would like to be a banana tree.
I won't be like a tree, redbud tree.
I would like to be a lemon tree.
I like to be a wiggly tree.
That is perfect. Well, thank you all for sharing, and we'll let you go. Now, what is the song?
Wow. As we receive from the earth what we need to survive, let us give so that we may express our thanksgiving for these gifts, so that we may move in harmony with the great cycles of giving and receiving. This morning, we recognize our new members who are the following. Would you please come forward? Sarah Lott, Alex Stinson, Heather Mingo, I think she's teaching. Oh, no, you're right there. Thank you. Good. Later. All right, great. Alec and Alicia Opheim. Alicia? Can you come forward? Oh, okay. All right. Today, we welcome into our community these new members who have chosen to make a commitment to this congregation by signing our membership book. New members, we are glad to have you here with us and that you have chosen this community of fellow seekers to travel with you on your life journeys. Will you accept our gifts of fellowship, discovery, and service? Will you offer us your unique presence and gifts? Will you add your name to the long history of Unitarian Universalist women and men who spread hope with our living faith? Will you engage with us as we seek to create a community and a world dedicated to love and justice? We will. All right. Congregation, will you welcome these new members with the warmth and comfort of your fellowship? Will you seek to add your strengths and talents to the new gifts they bring to us? Will you share our triumphs and our struggles as our community grows and changes? May this community of progressive faith help build the beloved community and search with courage and love for the evolving truth which asks us in each moment to follow what is true and celebrate this precious life.
Good morning. Well, it's been my good fortune to be a co-leader of a discussion group on the book Spiritual Ecology. We met five Wednesday evenings. There were 12 of us in the group, and I really appreciate the goodwill and willingness to participate and the open-minded and open-hearted listening and stimulating discussions that took place. It was really a very positive experience for me. And this, this is my entryway into UUFM is through these smaller discussion groups, and each and every one of them has been very illuminating, and I do appreciate the skills that Michael brings to the process. That certainly has contributed to the success of each one of them. In the spiritual ecology, there were 21 authors who gave their viewpoints on the crisis that faces people who inhabit the earth and all life forms. And one of them wrote, he actually happens to be the editor of the book, Llewellyn Vaughn Lee. He wrote urging people to hear the cry of the world, its call to us. Now, to hear the cry of the world, its call to us. Is it plausible to you that at this point in time, the earth might be crying out to you, to the human species, and perhaps to other forms of being? That's a legitimate question. Have you heard the cry of the earth? Does that phrase even make sense to you in your understanding of reality? If so, in what ways do you hear that cry? And how do you respond? That seems to be the question, the challenge that this book poses and the discussions that we had pose. Another author, her name is Susan Murphy, asserts that now we face a developing reality that can either condemn human beings to oblivion or inspire us to wake up to our lives in a dramatically more interesting way. In Murphy's view, this precarious moment in human and planetary history obliges us to begin considering the remaking of ourselves as ecologically awake human beings. Ecologically awake human beings. Murphy also urges us to wake up from the dream that we can live forever by massive damage to the earth. Now, those are just two samples of the messages that are conveyed by the authors of the book. People such as Thich Nhat Hanh, Joanna Macy, Wendell Berry, Father Thomas Berry, Vandana Shiva, and others. Buddhists, Catholics, Hindus, shamans, Native Americans, scientists, activists, Sufi teachers, a ruralist poet, a wilderness guide, a Jungian analyst, and others. So there was a tremendous diversity in terms of people who are coming at this spiritual ecology from their various backgrounds. But the commonality of those authors, their voices are united in understanding the features of the underlying worldview that causes humanity to currently dream that we can live on forever by massive damage to the earth. I want to just briefly outline these. These are big ideas, and we're not certainly going to have the time to illustrate them in any detail. But in terms of the diagnosis of the malaise, for one, a Judeo-Christian tradition that asserts the earth is in a fallen state and humans have dominion over all forms of life. A reductive scientific materialism that objectifies all matter, it's just stuff, and asserts that if it can't be measured, it's not real. And then, of course, the offspring of that, an industrial capitalistic society conducive to the modern religious sensibility, consumerism. Pretty much, these essayists agree that that's the underpinnings of the status quo that have created the crisis. And the crisis manifests in many ways, local and universal, but to illustrate one of the, I think, most portentous forms that it takes, we are currently engaged, launched into the sixth great mass extinction in planetary history. People are pretty well aware of that. That's pretty basic science, and it's human-induced for the most part. So there we have it. Now, what's the counterpoint to this? Because after all, we are exploring the ideas that perhaps the premises, the assumptions of our culture, of our fundamental sensibilities that inform and shape whatever we do in the material world, that's where the crux, that's where the nexus of this whole formulation lies. That's the premise of the authors, and certainly I accept that premise. Well, here's just a few, and keep in mind we're talking about 21 essayists here, but here are a few that are posed. The Earth is not just an object to be used, nor is it a problem to be solved. It is a living being in distress. We, this human species, are a part, an integral part of its suffering wholeness. And only from the place of sacred wholeness and reverence can we begin the work of healing, of bringing the world back into balance. Now, if you hear, as the subtitle of the book conveys, that cry of the earth, how do you respond? And there are, of course, many forms in terms of environmental activism and becoming more committed to various organizations that exercise their agency in fighting off some of the more destructive forms of capitalistic society. But I want to just reflect just very briefly here in terms of how this applies to me, okay? And this is going to be very broad brushstroke. But one of the things that I have discovered that works for me is that old phrase, a sense of place. Investigating, discerning the story of your particular home place and translating that through language into a story form that brings to the surface the texture of the history, both natural and cultural, of place. So that, for instance, my particular focus is on the Kanza or Kaw Indians, the tribe that the state is named for, so that if people want to access your story, then they will have a different understanding of what has happened in that place, and from that will have a different context and a different sense of identity, a different sense of their legacy, their inheritance, from which to act and make decisions in the present. It's an interesting thing, too. It's fun for me to be a part of that, and it's certainly very meaningful. But in a more moment-to-moment, in-the-now sensibility, okay, the form that it takes, and certainly not, you know, as nearly as successful as I would like to be, but to pay attention, just to pay attention to what's happening and to pay attention with trying as best we can to have a still mind and to be clear as much as possible of all that preconditioned sense of the separate self regarding the tree, the barred owl that comes in near our cabin where Judy and I built a cabin back in the 1980s, and we'll have a conversation. When we get on when I'm on the Kansas River in a canoe, certainly it's aesthetically, it's really neat. Every time I go out there, it's neat. Yeah, there's some pretty rough times when the south wind is roaring and you're having to fight that headwind. But it's always beautiful, surprising, and lots and lots of fun. But also, what the forms that appear, what are the possibilities for a kind of reciprocal a communication there? Now, we're taught very clearly, at least my background, and I think probably is similar to some of yours, that to project consciousness onto another animal or plant form and to presume that there's some sort of connection, okay, that is anthropocentric or anthropomorphic, okay? That means you are projecting. But perhaps that is just a belief that springs from the same traditions that we outlined in terms of what's formulated the basis for our culture. Perhaps there is more potential for a deeper relationship, a deeper sense of what can arise in the mutual contemplation of forms of life that we, to this point in our culture, consider marginalized and not capable of entering into that kind of relationship. Well, so I guess this kind of thinking, this kind of discussion that we've had, is something I really appreciate having access to, and it helps me to maybe wake up from the dream that has been inculcated in us in this particular civilization. This massive, monstrous situation that we have, that we are entitled to live by means of damage to the earth. And I really appreciate being able to dialogue with people who are concerned about the same thing. Thank you.
Can you hear me? Okay. That's kind of a hard act to follow. But I also want to thank our two leaders as well as all the members of the group because it was a really interesting discussion. And I think for me the most important part was to realize, which I had felt pretty strongly about already, being a part of the global world, but also being part of the universe and the fact that we are all made of the same materials. The basic fact came home to me. And so I felt like Ron that, and through these readings, that it was very important for me to be able to step out of the frame of reference that I had already always lived in, and to really listen and see with impartial eyes, not with the frame that had always been there. And I guess the third thing was that many of these authors stressed action, and to realize that positive action happens from the grassroots up. It doesn't happen with somebody presenting an idea from Washington or wherever. It happens from the grass up, which means that I also then have to be very active. I've tried to be very active. The only thing I cannot get rid of is books. I'm sorry. I just can't seem to bring myself to do that. But there was one example of activism which I wanted to share with you. The Navajo tribe this year faced a crisis. Years of drought means that they have less grass and water for their thriving cattle business. There is an overpopulation of wild or feral horses, resulting in scrawny cattle. It was agreed in the council to sell the horses for meat, which would be shipped to Canada, where it is legal, horse meat is legal, prepared at a cattle processing plant that had been newly remodeled for doing horse processing in a humane way. And then the tribal council thought some more and decided that not to capture and sell the feral horses for meat, because since captured from the Spanish in the 1500s, horses have become an integral, important, vital part of the Navajo culture. I hope we can preserve as we look out.
Thank you, Ron, Michael, the rest of the group. Greetings. If I had to choose a superhero, I would choose Eeyore. Recently, riding in a car with Michaela, I said it was a good thing I had a guardian angel, and she looked at me like, "You do?" And I said, "Well, I'm here." But though I really don't know if I have one, various things that have happened to me, including about 6 weeks before I was supposed to be born, tend to somehow make me think that I do. Of the varied authors, I tended to lean towards the thinking of the Native Americans quite a bit, possibly because they revered and respected and loved the very earth, the same earth that I walk on and the stream that I drink from. And the Zen Buddhists, because of my fairly extensive voyage through pottery forms and history and my life with them. It seems to me that the spiritual and the scientific are merely two perspectives of the finite and the infinite. A simplified version of the chemical reaction for the burning of wood is an amount of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, and this yields carbon dioxide and water in the form of vapor, plus a byproduct of light and heat. Our group gathered around a campfire the last evening of our discussions, and some words that I heard expressed and feelings were about ambiance and warmth and mesmerization, the magical dancing flames and smoke, the spiritual positive energies. Is a scientific equation for this phenomenon more or less valid than the relevance to and or of our energy or spirit of that flame? I think scientists and spiritual people are not on a disparate, conflicting path, but hopefully on a convergent one. Maybe someday a spiritual scientist will write an equation for that dimension of space, which is love, surrounding the yin and yang of life. Do I believe in superheroes? Not really. But I got to know Eeyore with my daughters. And to us, behind that slightly less and charismatic facade, lies a very humble, sincere, and loving heart. So maybe Eeyore is my guardian angel.
Well, we had short and tall, and now we have in the middle, but getting shorter. I have given this little presentation of mine a title just for my own amusement, and I'm calling it Lest We Be Merely Pickers of Blackberries. The late Thomas Berry, a Jesuit priest, paleontologist, and to use his own term, geologian, said that we need a new type of religious and spiritual orientation which must emerge from a new story of the universe, a new revelatory experience within the evolutionary process, which is from the beginning a spiritual as well as a physical process. Since we are born out of the Big Bang and have evolved from the elements of the universe, just as every other part of the universe, of the cosmos has, Berry calls the universe a primal sacred community. He describes a new echozoic age emerging based on what we now know of our universe story. Echozoic, coming from two words meaning house and living, hence a house of living things. These are some of Thomas Berry's insights. One, the universe is a communion of subjects, not a collection of objects. Two, the earth is a single reality which can exist and survive only in its integral functioning. Three, the human is derivative, the earth is primary. Four, everything is sacred. Nothing is profane. Five, we need new ethical principles which recognize the absolute evils of biocide, the killing of life systems, and geocide, the killing of the planet. Six, we live not in a cosmos, but in a cosmogenesis. As Homo sapiens, we are the tip of the Earth's evolutionary movement. Humans and Earth, says Berry, will go into the future as one single multiform event, or we will not go into the future at all. Berry calls for a reorientation of how we are in the world as religious beings. We must shift our attention from afterlife to this life, from spirit to matter. Not so much to merge the divine with the immanent, but to see in the immanent the divine. If there is no spirituality on the earth, he says, then there is no spirituality in ourselves. It is critical to unite in all aspects of our lives with one another and the earth. We must passionately resist dichotomy. The dichotomy of us versus the earth, of profit versus human and ecological flourishing, of intellect versus intuition and imagination. The dichotomy of things as object versus all creation as subject, of sacred versus profane, of religious versus secular. I think that the words of Elizabeth Barrett Browning, especially in this year of the beautiful fall, are perfect expressions of Thomas Berry's thought. She says, "Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush of fire with God, but only those who see take off their shoes. The rest sit round and pluck blackberries."
My name is Dick Gatchell, and I'm going to open with a quote from Joanna Macy, one of the essayists. "The loss of certainty that there will be a future is the pivotal psychological reality of our time." 20th century science undermined the notion of a self that is distant from the world it observes and acts upon. Einstein showed that the self's perceptions are determined by its position in relation to other phenomena. And Heisenberg, in his uncertainty principle, demonstrated that its perceptions are changed by the very act of observation. Systems theory says there is no logical or scientific basis for construing one part of the experienced world as me and the rest as other. As open and self-organizing systems are very breathing, acting, and thinking arise in interaction with our shared world through the currents of matter, energy, and information that move through us. In the web of relationships that sustain these activities, there is no line of demarcation. The total self-corrective unit that processes information is a system whose boundaries do not at all coincide with the boundaries either of the body or of what is popularly called self or self-consciousness. The self is only a small part of this system." Unquote. Once one connects indigenous peoples' attitudes toward the earth with our own scientific understanding of nature, their view of revering and communing with nature makes perfect sense. I never remember ever using the word epiphany for a new understanding I experienced, but Joanna Macy's essay provided that feeling, because three bits of information, which had no meaningful context before, came together, enlightening a new integration of nature, science, philosophy, and religion. A human being, and this is just as a summary, is a quote from Albert Einstein. "A human being is part of the whole called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. We experience ourselves, our thoughts and feelings, as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical illusion of our consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from the prison by widening our circle of understanding and compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty.
Can y'all hear me? All right. So this environmental crisis, as many of us discussed our experiences with during our Wednesday sessions, and as many of the authors brought up during the book, can be extremely overwhelming. My first kind of experiences with environmental issues started in college, where as a freshman I joined an eco-learning community, and we geared our gen ed classes, our communication, critical thinking, all towards about environmental issues. And as I went through my biotechnology degree, learning more about ecology and learning more about environmental problem solving and systems thinking, it was just, there was so much more information that it became, again, more overwhelming, to the point where I wanted to stop moving, desperately trying not to affect the earth, worrying so much about the things that I may have to adjust to my own life not to cause problems, that began to realize then that these actions and feelings I'm having are wholly unhelpful. They're not helpful for me making an impact or for helping other people make an impact. And as I went through and took some spiritual discussions, and as well through our discussions here on this book, I was again reminded and realized that we cannot help but affect the world around us. We are a part of this dynamic system and constantly interconnected with it. There are many passages in this book that helped me to visualize this. I pulled out a couple here for you. Bill Plotkin said that each of us is a facet of the one being that contains all. This idea came up multiple times and was also discussed through other spiritual traditions. For example, Indra's net from Mahayana Buddhism, as described by Jules Cashford. She described it as, "The universe is seen as an infinite net. Wherever the threads cross, there is a clear shining pearl in an infinite pattern of reflections. Each pearl is an individual consciousness, whether of a human being, an animal, a plant, a cell, or an atom. So a change in one pearl, however small, makes a change in all of the other pearls, each one singular and responsive to the whole." As you may have noticed in our prompt today, Albert Einstein came up many times in the book. And as a scientist, that was surprising for many of us. But you may be interested to know that he also is a Jewish mystic, coming from a tradition called Kabbalah. And he shared another way for us to think about this relationship. E equals mc squared. Energy equals mass times the speed of light. This equation is a visualization for the relationship between energy and mass, and that mass is a form of energy. You can go down to the smallest little subatomic particles and still see that there's this relationship and it is measurable. Kabbalic Judaism calls this energy the divine creative energy. And this means that every physical object is a form of energy that creates it. And Kabbalah helps us to realize and recognize the spirituality of matter, that every physical thing, even the inanimate, there is a soul. Bill Plotkin also discussed the idea of the soul, saying that each person has a unique ecological role, a role that he or she was born for, a singular way he or she can serve and nurture the web of life. Kind of sounds like an ecological niche to me. And that coming to an understanding of the nature of this unique ecological role or place that we are intended for is the intended outcome of our spiritual life. So like religion, finding your ecological niche and being able to interact with the world is different for every individual. There's no one path to solving this ecological crisis. There are many things that we can do, large and small, to be more, quote-unquote, environmentally friendly. And the authors pointed to some, but not really many, focusing, again, on that everybody has their own strategies and their own talents that they can bring. Reading this book reminded me that being environmentally sound is more about being willing to interact with the world, seeing yourself as part of the world and as an important actor as the bird, the tree, the microbes, and the soil. This book calls us to witness and, as I see it, facilitate this web of life. There are many ways to do this, obviously. We talked about one last week, the meadow at K-State, being in that environment and interacting and seeing nature. But as a community, I wanted to leave us with a question. One of the things that came up in our discussions was that the luxury that we had in order to be able to come every Wednesday, read the book, discuss and make choices based on environmental problems. In many ways, being environmentally friendly has become hard, inconvenient, and expensive, leaving many people without the luxury of time and money out of that discussion and out of being able to interact. So as a community, how can we be a beacon for those who don't have this luxury, and how can we facilitate and create opportunities for others to interact with nature and for other members of the Manhattan community to be a part of that? Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Mark Clark, and this was an interesting exercise for me. I come to thinking this way very lately, very recently. While I consider myself an ecologically minded individual, recycling, turning the heat down and the air conditioning up, driving a relatively economical car, some of the ideas and concepts presented in the essays within this book were at times difficult for me to relate to. Why would a reasonably intelligent and thoughtful individual, such as myself, believe such things just because I read them in an essay written by a supposedly prominent expert in the field? We've all read things that were penned by experts that were clearly flights of fancy, right? So I'm left with this dilemma. While I want my connection to the universe to grow in all ways, including in the spiritual sense, my logical, scientifically oriented mind is rebelling at some assertions being made in this book. Don't tell me trees have a consciousness and expect me to believe it out of hand. Likewise, don't tell me to think of our moon as more than a 4.5 billion-year-old basaltic rock. Right, Ron? I'll tell you about that story if you hit me up later. When I read the essay by Janine Marie Haugen entitled Imagining Earth, I have the solution to my dilemma. She asks us to consider her ideas as if they are true. I am free to imagine that they are indeed factual without immediately committing them to them as fact. This is a safer place for me personally. Now I can think deeply about these ideas and concepts as if they are more than just ideas and concepts, as if everything she asks us to believe were fact. The first paragraph of her essay lays this out beautifully, I think, and immediately puts me at ease to consider her assertions as if they are true. While those two words, as if, are only used once, you can hear this request repeated throughout. Her first paragraph reads, "If we approach rivers, mountains, dragonflies, redwoods, and reptiles as if all are alive, intelligent, suffused with soul, imagination, and purpose, what might the world become? Who would we become if we participated intentionally with such an animate earth? Would the world quicken with life if we taught our children and ourselves to sing and celebrate the stories embedded in the body of the earth, in the granite bones of mountains and rainy sky tears, in trembling volcano bellies and green-scented hills? What if we apprehended that by nourishing the land and creatures with generous praise and gratitude, with our remembrance for or tears, we rejuvenate our own relationship with the wild earth and possibly revitalize the anima mundi, or the soul of the world. I hope you feel the same way I do about that first paragraph, and that it allows us to consider these large ideas without having to commit to them immediately. So the next time a difficult idea is laid before you, or you're attempting to convey an idea to a doubtful audience, ask yourself or your audience to listen as if it were true. With that in mind, the author's words become even more alive and filled with possibility. If we approach rivers, mountains, dragonflies, redwoods, and reptiles as if all are alive, intelligent, suffused with soul, imagination, and purpose, what might the world become?
Well, I'm at the end because I can edit. I will just share this. Carl Jung: nature, psyche, and life appear to me like divinity unfolded. What more could I ask for? What I ask is for all of us to be committed to building a more perfect and beautiful and living connection to all that is, however you see it, however you feel it, however it moves through your being. May it be true and surrounded by love. Now let us sing our closing hymn, Blue Boat Home.
The accompaniment is not too much helpful as far as the tune is concerned, but it is helpful in knowing where you are and when to start. There are 8 measures of 3 beats before we start, and then there are, between the verses, there are 6. All right, ready to go? Are you ready?
Stand as
yeah. All right. All right.
Through the below me I feel no motion, standing on these mountains and plains, far away from the rolling ocean, still my craft and bark can say, I've been sailing all my life now, never harbor. Sun, my sail, and moon, my rudder, and as I fly the starry sea, leaning over the edge in wonder, casting questions into the deep, drifting here, my ship's companions, all we can. God, my sailor's song. I was born upon the fathoms, never harbor or port have I known. The wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue boat home.
Imagination is the living power and prime agent of all human perception, and is a repetition of the finite mind, of the eternal act of creation. In the infinite, I am.